Good morning, everyone. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, three times. Oh, I see why those old Chinese monks needed their green tea. Okay, please get comfortable because this is probably going to be one of those too long Dharma talks. But first, I just want to say how beautiful it is, you know, the way everybody's just kind of pulling together to make this session work under, you know, circumstances that were uncertain, still are uncertain. We've been living with uncertainty for a long time. And isn't our practice just about the best support for living with uncertainty and all that brings to us and to others? So my talk today is going to be only one and another can fully realize the Buddha Dharma. Co-awakening happens in so many ways and directions, between friends who share a lot of common ground, like Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder, both poets and activists living close to the land, teachers of many kinds and their students, disciples and apprentices. Parents and children awaken each other. Those of you, well, we've all been children, right? Some of us have been parents. And we know that parents and children awaken each other sometimes to their mutual delight, sometimes unwittingly, sometimes reluctantly, sometimes with a lot of kicking and screaming. not always in kind or skillful ways. A life partner commitment, whether marriage or otherwise, certainly can be a practice of co-awakening. Right? It teaches us the importance of ongoing practice, care, and maintenance for the long haul. All these human relationships teach us the paramitas, like patience, generosity, and the precepts. Of course, not killing, lying, stealing, misusing sexuality, or using substances and other behaviors that cloud the mind. There's also the more subtle ones, not disparaging others and inflating the self, not harboring grievances and ill will. Tonight is the full moon. So I think, actually, maybe for the evening service, we should renew our vows to practice the precepts. And we won't do the really elaborate high church long service because we're just barely keeping up as it is. Kay is relieved. We'll just do our kind of simple version, but since we're right here at Loon Lake on the full moon, I think it would be really lovely to do that. We practice these precepts, we learn the precepts, the paramitas, largely through our mistakes, our, what we call our mistakes or our failures. Right? That's how we notice. And perhaps we more rightly should call those our ancient twisted karma, our persistent conditioning. And the only way to untangle our ancient twisted karma is in relationship. We humans have made such a tangled mess of our collective relationships through our tribal us versus them mentality, whether based on religion, race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, class, any of the many ways that we divide and cut ourselves off from each other. I did a talk a few weeks ago about these collective identities and how they are conditioned and provisional. They have no inherent reality or truth. At worst, they have caused some of the most horrific human acts of violence and injustice perpetrated against the other. at best, a collective identity can support, can help sometimes to claim your own experience when your experience has been that of invisibility or denigration, denial, and can support understanding your experience and connecting with others who share it and building community. But any collective identity, and I should say collective identity has been a strong survival mechanism for persecuted minorities, yet any collective identity risks that kind of closing the ranks that can cut off possibilities for mutual understanding and healing of relationships with the other. You maybe have heard of the hormone oxytocin. I think it's sometimes been called the hugging hormone or something like that. It's produced not only in nursing mothers, who produce it a lot, but also in lovers when they hold each other. In any of us, when we pet our cat or dog, you know, whenever we feel a sense of comfort and togetherness, our bodies pump oxytocin. But that very same hormone can be enlisted in a sense of we, the righteous, are together against them, the unrighteous, you know, the other political party or religion or wrong-headed person on any side of a hot-button issue. So today, I'd like to talk about some examples of Kalyanamitta, remember that phrase, noble friendship, of co-awakening across those barriers of difference. And I was moved to consider this topic, one, by the disturbing level of polarization in our world and in our society today, in everything from international relations to families divided by acceptance or rejection of a vaccine. On the other hand, I've also been inspired by stories of people reaching out across the boundaries of difference to listen and carefully build friendship. I don't really think you need me to review the examples of polarization. They're all around us. So I will start right in with a story of two women of the 20th century whose friendship built over decades might provide some dharma for us all. Eleanor Roosevelt, a name you probably know, and Pauli Murray, a name you may not know. Eleanor Roosevelt would have been a household name for decades. She was a wife of President Franklin D. Roosevelt through the 10 years, remarkable 10 years of his presidency, record-setting length. But she was also known for her own writing and activism. How many of you do know the name Pauli Murray? Yeah, I thought Jess, yeah. Yeah, see? You soon will. She was a black, lesbian, American civil rights activist and lawyer, a writer, a poet, a devout Episcopalian who lived from 1910 to 1985. Through two world wars, the Great Depression, between them, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, the civil rights movement, the feminist and gay rights movements. She led a remarkable life with many obstacles which limited the recognition she might otherwise have received. And there's a brand new documentary just released called My Name is Pauli. My Name is Pauli Murray, which I think is quite likely to bring her name and work back into the public eye. I really want to see this film, but I'm going to have to swallow my pride and sign up grudgingly for the streaming service of a corporation of greed that begins with A, which I have not patronized for the duration of the pandemic. But I really want to see this film. Presents an ethical dilemma. Pauli Murray was born Anna Pauline Murray in Baltimore, Maryland, of mixed ancestry, including black slaves, free black people, white slave owners, and a Cherokee, part Cherokee great-grandmother. Her father was a school teacher and her mother was a nurse, but when she was only three, her mother died in pregnancy, and she was sent to live with her elderly grandparents and two middle-aged aunts, the aunts who she remained very close to for the rest of their lives. 10 years later, her father had a breakdown and was committed to a Negro psychiatric hospital, which was likely a horrendous place to be, where he was killed in a racially motivated murder. Those early losses shaped both her emotional vulnerability and her commitment to social justice. Murray was aware early in life that her gender identity was masculine. And after a very shortly lived teenage marriage, came to realize, if not fully accept, that she was romantically and sexually attracted to women. She always wore her hair short and unprocessed. But unprocessed, you know, black women in those days almost always straightened their hair. And she dressed plainly and androgynously, often wearing pants when women were expected, of course, to be in skirts. She chose to publish her first short story under the name Pauli Murray when she was 24 and continued to use that name. If she lived today, she might well have chosen to identify as a transgender man or as non-binary. So if I use she, her pronouns for Pauli Murray, it's not to erase or deny who she was, but rather I want to acknowledge the reality of the time she lived in and the courage it took for her to face discrimination, the discrimination she faced both in terms of race and gender and sexuality. That was a hard world to live in. Her educational history is complex and fascinating. She received a BA in English from Hunter College in New York City and was rejected in her application to the U of North Carolina because of her race. It was a segregated university. And she challenged that, but was refused support from the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, if you don't know that acronym. It was big in the day. She was not supported because of suspicions about her sexuality, most likely. Very strong male leadership then. Her involvement in several civil rights legal cases led her to choose law as a profession rather than literature. And to get a law degree from Howard University, graduating first in her class as the only woman. She was refused entry to Harvard Law School, not because of race, but because Harvard Law School did not accept women at all. Which she challenged. And despite a letter of recommendation from President Franklin Roosevelt, with Eleanor Roosevelt's urging, she was rejected. Murray wrote in response, "I would gladly change my sex to meet your requirements, but since the way to such change has not been revealed to me, I have no recourse but to appeal to you to change your minds. Are you to tell me that one is as difficult as the other?" She didn't pull her punches. She did postgraduate studies at U of C Berkeley, and at the age of 35, passed the California State Bar exam and became the first black deputy attorney general. 10 years later, at 45, she became the first woman to receive a doctorate in law from Yale Law School. Her work life was varied, often involved financial insecurity and discrimination in the field of law so dominated by men. Yet for decades, she continued to work with fierce determination for racial civil rights, workers' rights, women's rights, and later in life, speaking out for gay rights. And again, I'm using the language of the times so that those times are not forgotten. LGBTQ and its contemporary variants had not emerged then. It's important not to forget what earlier times were like, and to assume that the advantages that are now enjoyed sprang from nowhere. All through the decades, Murray maintained a vigorous correspondence with Eleanor Roosevelt, and the two developed a deep, warm friendship, which stayed strong and respectful even when they often disagreed. Roosevelt came from an utterly different background from Murray. She was born Anna Eleanor Roosevelt in 1884 in New York City. The Roosevelt family was wealthy and highly privileged. Her parents were sort of socialites. You know, they didn't have to work for a living. But that did not protect her from the death of her mother and baby brother of diphtheria, you know, before antibiotics, before vaccines, when she was 10, or the death of her father from complications of alcoholism. He was in delirium tremens and withdrawal and jumped from a window. So like Murray, she was raised by elderly grandparents. Unlike Murray, she went to an expensive school in London. They had what are called finishing schools, you know, to create a proper young lady. And she was forced to return for her social debut. You know, she was a debutante, rather than continuing her education. When she was 21, she married a distant cousin of her. She was born a Roosevelt. This is this dynastic family, right? And she married Franklin Roosevelt, who was a distant fifth cousin of her father, when she was 21, and had six children with him in the span of 10 years, one after another. The marriage was based on a kind of loyalty and a certain affection and duty. Because shortly after her last child, she discovered that he'd been having an affair with her social secretary for years. But she supported his career, his political career, even after he became partially paralyzed, which was believed to be polio, but probably wasn't. She encouraged him to continue in politics, and herself became more and more of a public figure. She published a regular column called My Day. And it wasn't just, you know, the trivia of her day. She talked about her responses to current events, and she was much more liberal and left-leaning than her husband, and she spoke out more and more, particularly in terms of social justice causes and civil rights. And like Murray, she was a lifelong Episcopalian, and her activism was supported and informed by an abiding Christian faith. If anybody's not sure what Episcopalian is, I'm not either. But I think it's sort of like Church of England, American version. Yeah, like Anglican. In Canada, we call it more like Anglican. Am I right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Now, so I want to read you a passage from this fascinating book that a friend recommended to me, The Firebrand and the First Lady, Portrait of a Friendship, Polly Murray, Eleanor Roosevelt, and the Struggle for Social Justice, by Patricia Bell Scott, who's a Black American scholar. And she's talking about the similarities between these two women. She says, they had inquiring minds. They were voracious readers. They loved poetry and they loved to write. They were unpretentious and they conveyed a seriousness of purpose that made them seem humorless, which was not the case. Both endured ridicule, Murray for her boyish physique. She was very petite, very small and slim. ER, she refers to Roosevelt as ER. ER for her protruding teeth. They had presence and phenomenal energy. They rarely slept for more than 5 or 6 hours a night. ER's daily schedule left those around her breathless, and Murray's intensity exhausted even her most patient friends. They first crossed paths in 1934 during the Great Depression, when Roosevelt visited a camp that she had helped to establish for unemployed women, where Murray was in residence. It was like the sort of forest, it was like Loon Lake. And it was a place where women, unemployed women, disadvantaged populations could go and learn skills and eat healthy food. And it sounds like quite a wonderful place. Murray loved it. Except that she became especially friendly with another woman and was gently, not so gently, expelled. Roosevelt and Murray did not meet there, but they crossed paths, and Murray was kept a kind of distance, distrustful of those who were kind of fawning over the First Lady. But the encounter gave her the impetus to write the first of many letters to E.R., along who she came gradually to call Mrs. R. As they became friends, she always called her Mrs. R. Along with the, she enclosed a copy of a long letter she sent to the president detailing the conditions of life for Black Americans in the South. I'm just going to read you the conclusion of the letter she sent to E.R., you know, trying to say, make sure your husband reads this. I know he has the problems of our nation on his hand, and I would not bother to write him, except that my problem isn't mine alone. It is the problem of my people, and in these trying days, it will not let me or any other thinking Negro rest. Need I say more? Sincerely yours, Pauli Murray. And Roosevelt writes back, my dear Miss Murray, I have read the copy of the letter you sent me, and I understand perfectly, but great changes come slowly. I think they are coming, however, and sometimes it is better to fight hard with conciliatory methods. The South is changing, but don't push too fast. There is a great change in youth, for instance, and that is a hopeful sign. Very sincerely yours, Eleanor Roosevelt. So that set the tone for their initial exchanges, which were quite feisty. Murray urging change in strong terms and Roosevelt counseling patience and moderation. But bit by bit, each of them expanded and modified their perspective. Roosevelt becoming more outspoken, a stronger advocate and ally, not only for Black Americans, but for workers and women. They began to meet in person. Before they became friends, they began to meet and have these little debates. But Roosevelt met Murray's feistiness always with warmth and openness, and sometimes with her own fortitude. And Murray came to trust and value Roosevelt's support and mentorship, really mentorship. Both, as they grew older, expressed care and concern for each other's health and well-being and for their families. Murray would often be frustrated with the president's heel dragging on civil rights and occasionally urged Roosevelt herself to go into politics. Later, Roosevelt became a delegate to the early United Nations, and Murray said, you're the first lady of the world. Much of their three-decade friendship was conducted via letters, like the poets Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder I shared with you Monday. I can't read you in that same way from these letters because they're only excerpted here and there in the book, and it's hard to take them out of the historical context without, you know, having to explain each one. But again, it was an era before the internet and email when people wrote long, well-considered letters. During the terrible years of the anti-communist hearings led by the notorious Joseph McCarthy in the early 50s, Murray decided, in her own words, as a serum against fear, to write one letter of personal faith each day to some friend or person. As a serum against fear, to write one letter of personal faith a day to a friend or someone. How would it be to take that up as a practice? Even for once a week, even once a month for us, let alone daily. She wrote to a friend, "I cannot live with fear, and the doctor has just told me I have a nervous heart. I call it a frightened heart. It has been frightened all my life because of race, the atmosphere which threatens one's integrity, an atmosphere of fear." Contemporary writers are doing a drawing connection between physical and mental health issues and the stress and fear of living in a racist society. I want to read you Murray's remembrance of her friend Eleanor Roosevelt. There were 26 years between them. That's another difference, 26 years difference in their age. After Roosevelt's death, this is what Murray said in a speech. "I learned by watching her in action over a period of 3 decades that each of us is culture-bound by the era in which we live, and that the greatest challenge to the individual is to try to move to the very boundaries of our historical limitations and to project ourselves toward future centuries. Mrs. Roosevelt, a product of late 19th century Victorianism, did just that, and she moved far beyond many of her contemporaries. I like to think that I am one of the young women of her time, touched by her spirit of commitment to the universal dignity of the human being, created in the image of God. Hopefully, we have picked up the candle that she lighted in the darkness, and we are trying to carry it forward to the close of our own lives." Murray had many health challenges throughout her life, and she died at about 75, I think, of pancreatic cancer. But late in her life, she made a change that baffled many of her friends. After all her years of activism, she entered theological school, and in 1977, at the age of 66, she was ordained as an Episcopal priest, just months after the church approved ordination for women. And she spent the remaining 5 years of her life, she only lived 5 more years. Oh, by the way, she was the first Black woman priest to be ordained. And she spent her last years in ministry and service, particularly in support of the dying. And here's how she described that change. "All the strands of my life had come together. Descendant of slave and of slave owner, I had already been called poet, lawyer, teacher, and friend. Now I was empowered to minister the sacrament of one in whom there is no north or south, no black or white, no male or female, only the spirit of love and reconciliation, drawing us all toward the goal of human wholeness." There's so much more I would like to tell you about her remarkable life and the way that she and Eleanor Roosevelt awakened each other, awakened for and with each other, and all beings. And they were not Buddhist, but that's what they were doing. They were living a bodhisattva life. I hope we'll all get a chance to watch the film. Maybe we could all watch it on one thing so we don't have to pay for the... But now I want to jump ahead to our own times and the work and writing of Irshad Manji. I don't know if you know her. She was a media personality, a journalist, Ugandan-born Muslim, lesbian feminist. And she's taken plenty of flack for her writing on and her reformist view of Islam. Her books have been banned, her life has been threatened. But her latest book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. And in it, she asked tough questions about identity, diversity, power, and politics, seeking ways to bridge the terrible polarized divides fraught with fear and animosity that so characterize the spirit of our times. Her language is colloquial, often humorous, and her discussion is framed by imaginary conversations with her old blind rescue dog, Lily, or Lil for short. She has these conversations with Lil. And that might sound a little gimmicky, but there's a reason behind her choice. She was raised in a culture that taught her dogs were evil and fearful. She was afraid of dogs. And so for her to take this step to adopt this old, somewhat cranky and frail, mostly blind little, there's a picture of her in here, this little scruffy dog, was a big act of courage. And Lily became her teacher. She credits Lily for making her a more humane human, less inquisitional, more inquisitive. Isn't that great? I heard Manji discussing this book in a CBC interview a couple of years ago, and I was struck by a story she told of her friend, Genesis B., a black activist rapper from Mississippi. So I'm just going to read you a little bit from the transcript of that interview. In 2016, Genesis staged an anti-racism protest in New York at a concert. The protest was aimed, among other things, at the Mississippi state flag, which contains a small Confederate flag as part of its design. While on stage, Genesis draped herself in a Confederate flag and put a noose around her neck. Manji, this is quoting Manji, many people took photos of that, and of course those photos went viral, and she got a gazillion death threats as a result. But among those violent messages was one from a guy named Lewis, a white man, Mississippian, with whom Genesis had gone to school as a kid, but had not seen in more than two decades. Lewis was a descendant of a Confederate soldier, and he told Genesis that while he disagreed with her view of the flag, he also disagreed with the hate she was receiving. The Mississippi state flag waves outside the state capitol building in Jackson, Mississippi. The flag has been the target of protests because of this Confederate flag. So Genesis actually reached out to her old classmate and invited him to her backyard and sat down with him and poured him a glass of water, a very hospitable thing to do in Southern culture. She asked him, "How does the Mississippi state flag make you feel?" And that question opened a discussion that fostered trust between the two. For him, it was a kind of loyalty to his family, a pride in his heritage. And he really had no idea the pain that image of that flag caused for black Mississippians. As a result of these conversations, over time, he ended up realizing that he cared more about Genesis than the flag. Over several more weeks, he realized that he actually doesn't need the flag to confirm his identity as the descendant of a Southern Civil War soldier. A while later, Manji called Lewis to double check a detail for writing her book. And he told her he'd taken down his Mississippi state flag. He'd folded it up and put it away in a box entitled Things in My Past. Wow. In another chapter of the book that's called Listening Without Agreeing, Manji gives more details of this developing conversation and surprisingly deep listening that transpired between Genesis and Jen, if Jen's or anything, and Lewis. And then she tells another story about a Jewish student who invited a white nationalist student because they heard each other playing country music on their guitars in the dorm. So that's how it came. So he invited him to Shabbat dinner. So every week, this white nationalist guy would come to Shabbat dinner with the Jewish guy and his friends. And they patiently inquired into each other's beliefs. They asked, you know, they read his pamphlets and listened to what he had taken as a given from his family. You know, his parents taught him this. And they calmly responded with their own perspective about the terrible suffering that could result from such beliefs to people he would never know as fellow human beings. And gradually, this white supremacist student opened and changed profoundly. And he said, looking back, that it was personal relationship, that someone was willing to listen to him without shaming him, without striking out at him. One of the researchers Manji consulted for her book commented that citing facts that dispute other people's biases doesn't actually make them more empathetic to a new point of view. To the contrary, it polarizes them. They get, you know, more entrenched and defensive. Here's what she says, what makes people willing to hear difference is knowing and trusting people whose worldview differs from their own. That's why those programs where they get kids together, you know, Israeli and Palestinian kids together to make music together or to play soccer together, or families of different oppositional backgrounds together to share a meal. That's why those things work. Could we imagine a caring and nuanced conversation between a vaccine-resistant person and a vaccine-accepting person? So many are struggling to say, how do you have that conversation? How do you have that conversation, right? The media sometimes don't seem to give us good examples. Maybe we should try and come up with some, huh? It seems like the kind of respect and civility that those two poets and those two social activists had in an earlier era is in scant supply today. And yet, these young people whose stories Manji tells are finding ways to recognize and affirm the humanity of the other. So Manji started a kind of institute or something for teaching moral courage, what she calls moral courage, training people in moral courage. So I'm going to give you her pointers for cultivating moral courage. One, self-evaluate habitually. In other words, pay attention. Pay attention. And here are some questions she has for us to ask ourselves. When I'm on social media, what stories do I pause for? What stories move me enough to share with my friends? What gives me joy when I watch, listen, or read about it? Sometimes we have to seek it out to go to sources, you know, not just our habitual sources. What makes me mad when it's in the news? Concentrate on issues, not individuals. What should be in the news much more than it is? What does all this suggest about the ideals that I stand for? Why do I stand for these values and principles? Are they choices I've made for myself, or the way my family has raised me, or an aha moment that inspired by others? Point two, defy the man for 1 hour a week. Okay, what she means by that is spend 1 hour a week face to face in open discussion with the other, someone with whom you are in opposition in some way. 1 hour a week. That's quite an assignment. Yeah? Imagine. The next steps that she suggests you practice, the next step she suggests that you practice with a family member who is opinionated or oppositional. And she says the reason for that is your family just can't, you know, walk away or fire you. Well, some families do. Some families do. In some cases, it's like friends, you know, will walk away or fire you. In some cases, it's the friends who stick by you and the family doesn't. So I just want to point that out. But these are good practices, and they are very congruent with our practice of the Bodhisattva precepts, and are likely to lead, if not to mutual awakening, at least to a softening and opening of the heart, a letting go of rigid views and judgments. So here they are. Launch the conversation by asking, could you help me understand what I'm missing about your perspective? Listen to understand, not to win. Ask more questions based on what you've heard. And by the way, always good to avoid yes-no questions. Basic counseling 101. And ask open-ended questions. How? What? Where? You know, go for details. Next, express your gratitude with tone and body language, too. When dealing with your other, don't berate, relate. Cute. Take a breath, or three. Three breaths, better than one. Be open to changing your mind. Be cool with non-closure. You don't have to wrap it up and settle it in one go. And walk away if you must, but not prematurely. Aren't they great? So the fact that none of these people I've included in this talk are Buddhist says to me that these qualities that we call bodhisattva qualities, wisdom, compassion, skillful means, determination, generosity, patience, respect, are not particular to any religion or other division of humanity. They are the birthright of us all. The great gift of Buddha Dharma practice is practice. Because without paying attention, it's much harder to have the insight, the wisdom, and compassion to have them arise, right? So, there's a short section in Dogen's Only a Buddha and a Buddha that we've been discussing this week that I've been pondering. A monk asks a Zen master, when hundreds, thousands, or myriads of things all come at once, what should be done? Feels like sitting doing Dokusan, people come in, I'm overwhelmed, you know, right? What should be done? It's too much. We've all felt that way, I'm sure. And the Zen master replies, don't try to control them. I felt that this exchange had something to do with my talk, but I wasn't quite honing in on what it was. And then I realized the connection. When we feel threatened, when we feel insecure, we want to control the situation somehow. Of course, we want to make it safe. And when we can't control the source of our anxiety, or sometimes even know what the source is, our human tendency is to project our fears and antipathy at someone or group different from us. So often, we externalize it, right? And we direct our efforts at controlling them, containing them, keeping them away, or vilifying or demonizing the other gives us a feeling of power and control. Even more so when we band together with others like us. I mean, just one example, the increased violence against anyone who looks like they might be Chinese since the pandemic, right? That externalizing. There seems to be a lot of that going on these days. Social, economic, and political instability breed insecurity and scapegoating. And the worries and oppositional voices seem to come in hundreds and thousands and myriads. And the old Zen master tells us not to control them, not to try to control them. But I don't think he means to ignore them. I think Dogen is telling us in Only a Buddha and a Buddha to see them as Buddha, with utmost respect, no matter how hard, to listen from the heart and speak from the heart, to deeply realize that only a one and another can awaken to the Buddha Dharma. And if you're not, if you don't feel ready to have that kind of conversation with some oppositional person in your life, you know, I know it's scary, write them a letter. You don't even have to send it. Write them a letter telling them not what's wrong with them, but something from your life, your hopes and fears, something you love doing, something beautiful you saw today. Just expressing that, just telling them about your life, may open your heart a little to the possibility that they have a life you might be able to hear about. What might you enclose in that letter? You know, the little origami or the seeds or the dried flower. You can even write a letter to someone who has died. It's a really good thing to do too. So as you can see, I'm clearly on a roll with this letter writing thing. So I promise I'll do it too. Maybe I'll write one to you. Thank you. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for being here. And also to the folks on Zoom who I didn't specifically greet at the beginning. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here at beautiful Loon Lake on a frosty morning. May our intention equally extend